I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be speaking to the longtime geopolitical commentator, sometimes controversial, but always rather fascinating, Pepe Escobar of Consortium News and The Asia Times. Pepe initially joined me to discuss his new book, The Raging 20s. Great Power Politics Meets Techno-Feudalism. But very quickly, our conversation turned towards what Pepe referred to as the sort of preamble to what he writes about in The Raging 20s. The book covers the year of 2020 in terms of geopolitics and the COVID pandemic. Our conversation covers a lot of the events leading up to 2020 and what it means going forward. Now, you may not agree with all of Pepe Escobar's views on certain matters related to geopolitics, but as always, I strive to provide a rich diversity of voices that are thinking outside the box. Whether that be Pepe on one hand or another thinker who I think would have disagreements with Pepe on some matters, but also some similarities, namely Alfred McCoy, who I actually mentioned in the course of our conversation. In any case, I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Pepe Escobar, author of The Raging 20s. Great Power Politics Meets Techno-Feudalism. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been reading for a number of years now, writing for Consortium News and The Asia Times, and also the author of a new book entitled The Raging 20s. This is a very fascinating book, and the subtitle is Great Power Politics Meets Techno-Feudalism. Pepe Escobar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening from Southeast Asia, everybody.
So, Pepe, if you could, for my audience, why did you title this book The Raging 20s? And maybe you could describe a little bit about what you're trying to deal with in this book. It's very heady at times. I mean that as a compliment.
Of course, I took it as a compliment. In fact, a lot of people are puzzled by the title, in fact, which there is an inbuilt literary homage to the Roaring 20s, especially Fitzgerald and Hemingway, which are two of my teenage idols, in fact. And of course, raging because this decade started with a murder. And that's something that I address right from the start at the introduction, and in fact, in the first column in the book, which was the assassination of General Soleimani on January 3rd at Baghdad airport. So that more or less set the tone, I would say, set the tone for the rest of the decade, which is going to be extremely heavy. Just look at what's going on now, in fact, where now, especially these past 3 weeks, the geopolitical chessboard is now crystal clear, even to people who do not follow geopolitics. We have the US and NATO on one side, and we have Russia, China, and Iran, the three big sovereign powers on the other side. So this has the potential to be, in fact, raging would be, in fact, an euphemism to what's coming ahead.
If I could, I want to get your thoughts on something that has been happening recently. Our Secretary of State here in the U.S., Antony Blinken, went to Germany and was trying to say to Angela Merkel, you need to shut down the Nord Stream 2 pipeline between Germany and Russia. And Merkel was very emphatic, basically just saying no. What do you make of that development and how it may play into things geopolitically? Because that's been on my mind lately.
Extremely important. In fact, I'm working on a huge column this week exactly on what is this whole propaganda campaign about Russia sending a lot of troops to the Russian border, in fact, to the Donbass border with Ukraine, which is exactly the, you have to read the whole thing upside down. It's because Kiev has, for all practical purposes, declared some sort of undeclared war against Russia. The proclamations by the Rada in Kiev these past few days, by Zelensky. And of course, because this is a propaganda war, the whole EU-NATO apparatus, and obviously the American mainstream media, they turn it upside down. And now the narrative that they are trying to impose, not only in Atlanticist circles, but to the rest of the world, is that Russia is about to commit some sort of aggression against Ukraine, which is complete bullshit. Everybody who actually follows what happened since the start of the Minsk agreements, the fact that Kiev never respected the Minsk agreements, their bombing and shelling of even civilians in Donbass near the so-called line of control between the Ukrainian army and Donetsk and Luhansk republics. Anyone who follows this closely knows that this is absolute nonsense. And obviously, the Russians have excellent intel on every movement by Kiev's forces. And if, all the signals point to a very strong possibility of some sort of blitzkrieg. And this is how Russian intelligence and the Russian Ministry of Defense is reading it. What we're all discussing, in fact, frenetically for the past few days, is how this would happen. The degree of the response by Moscow, which would be devastating, to say the least, not, of course, including an invasion of Ukraine, because there's nothing in Ukraine that is worth it for the Russians. In fact, the really important matter is the situation of the Donbass, of Donetsk and Luhansk, and the fact that we have at least, if not more, 450,000 residents who now are Russian passport holders. So they're Russian citizens. This means they have to be protected by the Russian Federation. If they start being bombed or shelled or victim of a blitzkrieg by the Ukrainian forces, we have a pretty good idea how the response is going to be. Remember Georgia 2008. So it's going to be Georgia 2008 on steroids. And it could last 48 hours, maximum 72. Everybody in Kiev who has half a brain knows that. Everybody in the European Union knows that. Remember that a few days ago, we had a teleconference, Putin, Macron, and Angela Merkel. Nobody else. It was not Russia with NATO or Russia with the EU. It was Russia with the two nations that really matter in the EU, Germany and France. And obviously, there was no smoking gun because very few substance was leaked. But we know for sure that Putin sent a message, a personal message, to both Macron and Merkel. Look, take a look at all that gang of lunatics that you have here in NATO and receiving orders from the American generals. If they try anything that is considered lethal or actually lethal against the people in Donbass, our response is going to be really, really Metallica style, you know. So they got the message. The problem is Macron and Merkel cannot influence those neocon lunatics in Washington or the people in NATO who receive orders from the lunatics in Washington and then pass the orders to those other lunatics in Kiev. So it's an extremely volatile situation with a very strong possibility of a hot war, which if there is hot war, like I told you, is going to last 2 or 3 days max, because the Russians have everything in place to, in fact, cripple the blitzkrieg in the bud. This means in the first few hours already. Like the Ukrainians won't even know what hit them before they have the chance to advance across Donbass territory. Because what they really want to do is to take over the two big cities, Donetsk and Luhansk. That will be the meaning of this blitzkrieg. They're not interested in the countryside. They're not interested in this area, which is probably 100 kilometers between the line of control and the big cities. They want to take over the two big cities. So the Russians will do everything and more to prevent that. So we already know the correlation of forces, right? So this is about the terrain. But it's much more complicated than that, because it involves the relationship between Germany and Russia, which is what the Americans, especially the Dr. Strange Love fanatics across the Beltway, have in mind. We need to prevent Nord Stream 2 by any means necessary. So the thing is, you try to create a global perception, and especially an European perception, that Russia is about to attack Ukraine. So you can transfer this perception to, how are you going to build a pipeline with these guys? You know, buy gas from these guys. Buy gas from us, the United States. 5 times more expensive, you know, but it's good for you. You shouldn't do deals with those evil Russians. So this is the level, the cognitive level of the propaganda campaign. So it is I'm sorry if I had to extend myself a little, because it's an extremely complex scenario. I tried at least to give you the basic lines at the moment.
I think a lot of the things we're dealing with now are very complex, and I'm glad to have you on to sort of break it down for my audience. One of the other things I really wanted to pick your brain about is maybe discussing how we got here to this point where there's sort of this sort of trio we have with regards to China, Russia, and Iran. Because at one point, you know, the U.S. was trying to seemingly do a Russian reset, maybe try to normalize relations. I believe that was attempted failingly during the Obama years. And also we had the Iran nuclear deal. That went out the window, of course. How did we get to this point where Iran and China and Russia are now sort of coalescing?
Because they have been doing this for at least in detail for the past 6-7 years. Since the launch of the New Silk Roads, which was 8 years ago, was 2013, was literally yesterday. The New Silk Roads were launched by Xi Jinping first in Astana, now Nur Sultan in Kazakhstan, and then in Jakarta, the Overland Silk Roads and the Maritime Silk Roads. And they start clinching deal after deal with, now it's 130 nations that are part of the Belt and Road Initiative. International organizations as well. The most of the global South has some sort of project linked to Belt and Road. The Chinese were very effective into the way they would sell Belt and Road as really a win-win partnership with especially countries across the global South. Even countries in Europe are part of Belt and Road. When Italy 2 years ago announced that they were a partner to Belt and Road, all sorts of pressure by the Americas and by Brussels over Italy. This is something I follow very closely as well because of Italians who are connected to China, especially. And Russia developed their own vision, which is called Greater Eurasia. This is something that you will never read about in American mainstream media. Never. But it's very, very serious because, let's put it this way, and I'm being very synthetic here. It's their vision that is complementary to the Chinese New Silk Roads, but with a Russian emphasis. And it's not only restricted to the former Soviet area of influence, which is, for instance, in the Eurasia Economic Union. The vision of Greater Eurasia includes Russia doing deals with nations in the Middle East, with nations here in Southeast Asia, my neighbors, like they have with Vietnam, for instance, with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So it's an integrated Russian vision for Eurasia that complements, runs in parallel, and intersects with the Chinese vision, which is basically their foreign policy initiative, which is also a trade initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative. So, and Iran now, especially since the past 2 weeks, with that groundbreaking announcement in Tehran of the China-Iran strategic partnership, 25-year, it can be anything to 400 billion to 600 billion or even more, because it involves a lot of investment in trade and connectivity and a lot of oil and gas that will be bought by China on a regular basis for the foreseeable future. So Iran now is a case of national security for China in terms of being a supplier of a reliable supplier of energy, oil and gas, and Chinese investments in the sprawling energy industry in Iran. And they need that investment badly to upgrade their installations. So when you put this all together, it makes total sense. What is extraordinary, which is something that in history, sometimes we see it sporadic. Usually we see it sporadically. You have 2 weeks that concentrate a series of events that could have been taking place over one decade, two decades, half a century. And in our case, it happened in 2 weeks. We had Russia and China getting closer and closer. That visit by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi the visit by Lavrov, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to Wang Yi in Guilin, where they discussed how they would get the strategic partnership closer and closer after Alaska, which was an absolute disaster, as we know, especially because our friend Tony Blinken has no stature as an international diplomat. He's a base. Tony Blinken is an apparatchik who used to write speeches for Joe Biden. Come on, this is ridiculous. This guy doesn't know anything about foreign policy or diplomatic rules or to deal with the real heavyweights in the business, such as Yang Jiechi or Sergei Lavrov, or even Zarif from Iran. Zarif can run rings around Tony Blinken like this. You know, it's a joke. So that's the problem. You have an Obama-Biden 3.0 administration composed of amateurs with some support, very heavy support in the background of very, very dangerous neocons, never Trumpers or total neocon, 100.
Do you mean like the Robert Kagan type characters?
The Robert Kagan types, exactly. So that's what makes it so dangerous, because it's a mix of apocalyptic, very dangerous apocalyptic types and extremely immature and even childish types who have no idea of how international relations work. And in fact, they have no idea how to conduct a summit, which is something that we saw in Alaska. You know, it was embarrassing for the United States to conduct a summit with the number one trade power in the world and the number one economic power in the world, like that, you know. And this was, it doesn't matter what American public opinion thinks. What matters is what the whole planet is thinking when you look at this, you know. It's a graphic illustration of how diplomacy for the United States now it's a detail.
I was just going to add to that. It's interesting you mentioned how you know, some of these figures trying to do diplomacy right now, maybe amateur hour. I was thinking recently of Zbigniew Brzezinski. I've been revisiting some of his work, The Grand Chessboard, and I think he'd be rolling in his grave at this point. And I'm not saying he's like some great guy or anything, but he was pretty smart about stuff, even if you would disagree with his ultimate goals. And I think one of his big things was always never let, you know, Russia and China get too close. And the U.S. really slipped on that one. What do you make of the U.S.'s failures to play the game?
Look, if you reread The Grand Chessboard, it's explicit. Explicit. Prevent by all means the emergence of a peer competitor in Eurasia. Look, in 1997, when he published the book, it was peer competitor. In his mind, it was Russia. But Russia in the 90s, as we all know, was completely devastated. So obviously, Brzezinski, surveying the chessboard, he said, look, it's not going to happen anyway. But still, we have to keep the pressure and we have to smash any possibility of Russia reemerging as a great power in Eurasia. And obviously, he was not thinking about China. Don't remember that 1997, I was there at the time. I covered the Hong Kong handover. It was still the beginning of, you know, reunification of China. They had a long way to go. They were not even members of the World Trade Organization. Just to give an idea of this, this is a long, long, long time ago. Well, what happened is, especially during the Trump administration, we had the emergence, little by little and in detail, not only of one peer competitor, but of a strategic partnership with two peer competitors who now are working side by side in every major decision geopolitically is discussed by them. Geoeconomically, of course, is different because the firepower of the Chinese is, you cannot compare Russia with China in terms of financial muscle, of course. But Russia, now that their house is in order, they are, you know, they diversify their industry, which sanctions was very helpful to diversify Russian industry, for instance. They are doing more and more deals outside of their former sphere of influence. Like what I mentioned before, for instance, in Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in South America, so, for instance, with Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, etc. So Russia is expanding all over the world again, little by little, according to their means. The Chinese, as we all know, Belt and Road Initiative is not only Eurasia. It's Eurasia, Africa, and includes South America as well. Not to mention everywhere in the Middle East, especially now with the China-Iran partnership. So I would say Brzezinski is on a 24-7 desperation in his tomb or in Nirvana, if he was admitted to Nirvana, because his worst nightmare, and not only his worst nightmare, the worst nightmare of every think tank in the Beltway, in fact, because everybody in the Beltway more or less rehashes what Brzezinski wrote in 1997. So, you know, if you go to the Hudson Institute, the Heritage Foundation, it's everywhere is the same thing. So, so what do we do? That's what they're asking themselves. You start to create provocations. There's an ongoing provocation in Syria where with that American continuous stealing of oil in northeast Syria, bringing more forces from Iraq, China, because it's basically...
You cut out there for a second. You said bringing more forces to Iraq, and then you cut off...
From Iraq, crossing from Iraq. Yeah, of course. And of course, Ukraine Donbass, which is the number one flashpoint at the moment, with a strong possibility of becoming, even for 48 hours, a hot war. And obviously, Kiev won't do anything if it's not authorized by Washington. It's not even authorized by Brussels. NATO. It's authorized by Washington. So we now depend on some measure of sense in the heads of these fanatics in Washington to prevent the whole thing turning into a hot war. This is where we are at the moment. It's terrible to admit it, but this is realpolitik. If they give a green light to Kiev, we're going to have this blitzkrieg happening with unforeseen consequences, some of them dire. And Putin already said, look, if we identify who gave the orders for an attack against us, we're going to counterpunch with the people that really matter. So this is an indirect way of saying, look, you know, it's not going to be Eastern Ukraine, Eastern Europe, or even Brussels. It's going to be D.C. So, you know, pay attention to what you're doing. It's a very, very serious situation. For instance, this week we were, I was reading an excellent summary of the whole situation by probably the best Russian analyst of everything about Ukraine and Russia, Rostislav Ischenko, which I had the pleasure to meet in Moscow 3 years ago. And Ischenko was saying, look, this is as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than the Bay of Pigs. So this is where we are, you know. And obviously, I don't see this being discussed in American mainstream media.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's not making the headlines?
Because you can, if you start discussing in detail, you're going to have to give much more information that they are willing to divulge, which is basically that this is a propaganda and a provocation operation. It's the same thing about Xinjiang. The whole Xinjiang thing now is being deflated because not only China is saying, look, this is basically a CIA operation against us, centered on our key intersection between China and Central Asia and Belt and Road across Central Asia. Why Xinjiang? Why they are not targeting Fujian or somewhere in the southeast or something in the northeast or Sichuan in the middle of China? No, they are targeting the direct connection between China and the rest of and Western Asia. You know. That's the major problem, because if they start more or less trying to explain what's really going on in between Ukraine and Donbass, most people are going to question the narrative. First of all, because there is no narrative. The only narrative they have is Russian aggression. Okay, prove that the Russians are on a sort of aggression campaign against. No, the Russians are going to say, they're going to say immediately, look, why are we bringing more troops to the border? Because, look, and here's the proclamation. And they show you the proclamation translated into English. The Ukrainian parliament practically declared war against us. Their president practically declared war against us. So that's it. And against us means especially against our citizens who live in Donbass. So Donbass, for the moment, is in, let's say, a political limbo. But now it's a territory inhabited by a lot of Russian nationals. So that changes completely the whole thing, you know. So Russia will see it as an attack on Russians, which it is, because practically everybody who lives in Donbass, I would say certainly more than 90%, if not 95%, their allegiance, in cultural terms, linguistic terms, historical terms, is with Russia. Industrially, their industry was always geared towards Russia. The language that everybody speaks, I was there in 2015. Everybody, their number one language is Russian. It's not Ukrainian, you know. So it has nothing to do with Ukraine, in fact, is already divided. And if there is this blitzkrieg, maybe we can have statelets appearing here and there. We're going to have the Poles trying to grab a slice of Western Ukraine. So it's going to be, and this is something that Putin said, and Lavrov said again 2 or 3 days ago, explicitly. If they try anything stupid, it will be the end of Ukrainian statehood, which you should read as, you know, that country as we know it will be gone. And still, they keep the provocations.
So, in regards to what is happening geopolitically, just maybe more broadly for a second here, what do you make of the Quad? I also wanted to ask you about that and how it fits into the geopolitical maneuverings right now.
Well, the Quad is, well, apart from, I would say apart from the four of them involved, for everybody else, it's a joke. Like, even here in Southeast Asia, people look at the Quad and say, what is this? It's a talk shop, essentially. Can we seriously believe that the Japanese and the Australians are stupid enough to form a sort of armada to go against China? It's ridiculous. The Indians is much more complicated because, for instance, what is Putin trying to do? Putin is trying to bridge the gap between Modi and his Hindu nationalist fanatics, nutcases, backers, and China. And don't forget, there are three of them are BRICS nations. So they should be working together at the moment, and they are not. You have India sabotaging China all the time. And Russia, which is the, let's say, the stabilizing force inside BRICS, they already know that Brazil for the moment is completely gone, vanished. It's going to take a long time for the B to be back to BRICS. So at the moment, it has to be RIC, RIC. And it's not. It's only RC. So Putin, Lavrov, everybody's doing their best to, okay, let's bring Modi back, talk to Xi, forget about this containment of China bullshit, which is once again a Washington black ops, essentially, against China. But that's very complicated because of internal Indian politics, because Modi is a guy who swings back and forth. You know,
I was going to say, is it possible, not to interrupt you, but is it possible that India maybe flips its allegiances at some point, so to speak?
We don't know. We don't know because they don't have a solid foreign policy with Modi and these people backing him, the Hindutva nationalists, which are basically racist against everybody else. Huh? Which is even crazier, and this is something that when you talk to seasoned Indian diplomats, and some of them are absolutely outstanding, they say, look, these people, they believe that they're going to be equal partners to the Americans. It's completely absurd. The Americans will use and discard the Indians just like that. They will never be equal partners in Quad. You know, the Americans may force the Indian Navy to be a sort of a patrol force in the Indian Ocean and all that. But this is, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And there's no, even the intention of having the other three Quad members to be on a deciding level. Every directive, let's put it this way, will come from Washington. And obviously, to have a mechanism like that, which is basically a containment mechanism with no incentive for all the three other partners, apart from, you know, put more money here in the kitty for more, you know, ships or missiles or whatever. Yeah, come on. What kind of broad-based program, constructive program is that? There's nothing, you know, nothing. So everybody else, apart from the three ones, the other, India, Australia, and India, here across Asia, from Southwest Asia to here, Southeast Asia, and Central Asia, they look at Quad, they say, nah, it's whatever.
Now, what's interesting to me is really what we're getting around to talking about here is, I think, the decline of the American empire. And I see more and more people talking about that, even when they disagree on other issues, maybe. I just had Alfred McCoy on. We were discussing the decline of American empire, and he has different views than others on things like China. He is not necessarily enthusiastic about the rise of China. Other people disagree with that. But it seems like there's an agreement that the age of Pax Americana is on the way out. I was really interested in a comparison you made. You sort of, in the book, talk about Pax Americana, and you compare it to the Mongol Empire. Could you describe that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, the Pax Mongolica, don't forget, it lasted a little less than 150 years, which compared to Pax Americana, which has been lasting for 70 and is on the way down, in broad historical terms, was even longer than that. But when they started to be corroded from the inside, which was basically a fratricidal war, all the descendants of Genghis Khan start fighting among themselves. The decline was inevitable. So we had different silos inside the Mongol Empire. So after that, the decline was absolutely inevitable. In the US, we can have a comparison in terms of the internal corrosion of the empire. We can have straight out neocons like the Paul Wolfowitz gang. No? We have the humanitarian imperialist gang, which is now in power with the Dems. We have isolationists still. And we have flat out imperialists. Whatever you want to do, whatever, if you want to do shock and awe, if you want to go preemptive, if you want to do R2P, we don't care, as long as you control everything. So these are different factions of more or less the same imperial mentality. It's our way or the highway, which is essentially what the empire still is. The problem is they don't have the means anymore to sustain our way. The highway now has a lot of people are traveling the highway, including the three sovereigns, Russia, China, and Iran. And in the rest of the global south, nobody pays attention to the U.S. anymore. You know, they suffer the effects, of course, because of the role of the dollar, the fact that the U.S. controls the international financial system, the Bank of International Settlements, all these the central banks all over the world, etc. But little by little, they are looking at alternatives. I say, look, let's align with China. Let's align with Russia and China. Let's try to trade using our own currencies, bypassing the U.S. dollar, which is something that more and more is going to happen for the rest of the decade, starting with Russia and China and Iran. But soon, we can have, for instance, nations in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Southeast Asia, bypassing the dollar increasingly. And eventually, don't discard that, even in South America. If we already have a sort of new pink tide again in South America, and all these new governments, leftist governments or progressive governments in South America, they know exactly what it is to be subjugated by the hegemon, by the empire. So this is going to change. Okay, much slower than other parts of the world, but it's also inevitable. So, coming back to the book, all this that we are discussing is more or less the preamble to what's going on now is what you're going to read in the book, because the book basically chronicles last year, 2020. And there are two narratives. One narrative is all the repercussions of COVID-19. And the other big narrative is great power politics. And it's basically centered on Russia, China, and Iran, and how they were getting more and more integrated, and how Eurasia is getting more integrated. So now we are in all these contradictions that were accumulating last year, they are exploding now in front of us, in fact. And that's why as each month, the decade becomes even more complex, because we won't be able to escape these contradictions for much longer. You know.
I want to delve.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to delve more into some of the issues you get into when it comes to COVID and this sort of surveillance capitalism and hyper surveillance state we live in. But since you mentioned the neocons a great deal, and I know this is still more of the preamble stuff, but how much of what we are experiencing today is in part due to the long shadow, so to speak, of the war on terror that was, you know, basically the architects of it were the neocons?
Absolutely. It's a good question. I follow this thing from the inside since before 9/11. And after 9/11, in fact, at the time, especially in the first few years, from 2001 to 2005 or 6, I was into it practically all the time. I didn't even have an apartment in the first 3 years. You know, I was living literally on the road, you know, between Iraq, Afghanistan, and, you know, those threats against Iran all the time. And the whole psychosis of the war on terror and how it affected life inside the United States and everywhere else, the satellites, all those false leads provoked by the war on terror, all the developments after shock and awe 18 years ago, which is something that at the time we could already see in Iraq. I remember very well that 9 days after the fall of a Saddam statue in Tahrir Square, there was the first big anti-American demonstration. Huge. There were like 500,000 people in Baghdad, and very, very important, something that I would never expect to see. Sunnis and Shiites side by side in the streets. 9 days. And that, so 9 days after the mission accomplished, we could see where this thing was going. So sooner or later, the Americans, they're going to be fighting different insurgencies, Sunnis, subdivided Sunnis, Shiites in the south, Shiites in the center. And this is exactly what happened throughout the 2000s. Even with the petrol surge, 2007, didn't solve anything. The only thing that petrol did was distribute a lot of cash to a lot of people in the Sunni areas, in the Sunni triangle especially, to get rid of Al-Qaeda, which is something that they were already trying to do. And they did by themselves, and now with the extra incentive of those Samsonites full of cash, right? And then they would turn against the Americans, which is something they did afterwards. You know? So we could see that already in 2003. And obviously, the neocons ensconced in DC, in the Beltway, in their, you know, aircon think tanks, they had no clue whatsoever of what was going on the ground. And especially the first, you all remember the first few months of that ghastly coalition provisional authority. It was unbelievable to see this. They had absolutely no clue where they were. The only thing that they had in their minds, okay, it's going to be creative, in fact, non-creative destructions. You know, we're going to destroy everything and start from scratch.
Do you think that these sort of massive failures with the war on terror, maybe other countries looked at that and said, well, maybe America isn't really the hyperpower. Maybe that was a facade, and it has sort of left an opening for new powers to rise and maybe for a return to what has been called by previous guests of mine, like Patrick Coburn, basically the multipolar world.
Absolutely. Patrick's coverage in Iraq was absolutely great. You know, he was probably the best Western reporter covering Iraq on the ground nonstop for years. And obviously, he saw that in detail, the corrosion of the empire in the wider Middle East. And nowadays, we call it the axis of resistance, which is Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Hezbollah. At the time, this axis was very slow building. was, you know, one step at a time. Only, I would say, only 3 or 4 years ago, especially after the Russian intervention in Syria in 2015, then we finally saw the contours of how close they were working, you know, Iranian military advisors, a command and control center in Baghdad coordinating everything, Iran and Hezbollah helping Damascus in Syria and the Syrian Arab army. The role of Hezbollah as, you know, fighters on the ground, commanders on the ground, but also logistical experience and strategic advice as well. So, and now this is absolutely established on the ground. And there's nothing the Americans can do against it. Nothing. Nothing. So on the ground, we could see that progressing little by little. And obviously, while the Americans were with this neocon-induced war on terror obsession, China was absolutely free to keep growing at 10-12% a year, investing like crazy, accumulating reserves, you name it. And then one day, via their Ministry of Commerce, they had this brilliant idea. Ah, let's expand to the rest of Asia. And why not all the way to Europe? So that was the birth of the New Silk Road in 2013, which was an original trade project. And it became a foreign policy project. And the Russians under Putin were, wow, restarting from scratch, literally, you know. This is it's something that I followed closely as well. I covered Putin's election in 2000. Just to give an idea, 21 years ago, when he was elected president in March 2000. And I remember very well that Russia was devastated, completely devastated. It was almost one of those horrible terminology, a third world country in many aspects. And by 2007, 2008, the situation was very, very different. It's when Putin made that famous Munich speech saying that the unipolar world is not a good idea. We don't agree with that. And obviously, in the previous decade, where they were reorganized as a society, their military was upgraded. They had most of their top weapons, the top weapons that we learned for the past few years that they have, the hypersonic weapons, you name it. And it's another story. And throughout all this period, from the start of the war on terror in 2001 to the Russian intervention in Syria in 2015 to the Trump administration this past 4 years, Russia and China, they were doing their jobs for their own populations and in terms of organizing and reorganizing themselves. And obviously, in the past few years, strengthening the strategic partnership, because they knew that if they want to change anything in terms of international relations, it cannot be under the rules-based international order that our friend Tony Blinken is regurgitating every day. In fact, it's his official motto. Nobody in the global South with power believes in the rules-based international order anymore. So that's what they're doing. They are trying to forge an alternative rules-based order. And when they mean rules-based order, means respecting national sovereignty, respecting the rule of international law, respecting decisions by the United Nations, everything that the empire doesn't do. Because the empire is, by definition, unilateral. So this is the process for the past 20 years. And when we look in retrospect, it makes total sense. At the time, we couldn't see all the pieces in the puzzle, you know. And that's why what we're living now, these first 3 months of, 3 months, the first 3 months of 2021 is so important, because now the pieces are falling. And now we can actually now see the jigsaw puzzle in detail, you know.
So I know we're coming up on the hour here. I just had a few more questions that maybe we could tackle. The first, for my listeners that are unfamiliar with that term multipolar world or just hearing it more now, what do we mean when we say a multipolar world? Because I always like to maybe give a definition for folks that are just becoming interested in these topics.
Well, we can have many different definitions of multipolar world. First of all, it's absolute opposition to an imperial hegemonic way of conducting international relations, which is what we had until recently since the end of the Second World War. This means that Pax Americana is 1945 to, let's say, the previous decade, before the raging 20s. And now, countries, there are real sovereigns. And the way I see it, and this is very clear in the book, the key essay in the book is titled Eurasia, the Hegemon, and the Three Sovereigns, Russia, China, and Iran. This is, if the book is like a tree, this is the trunk, you know. It's the most important essay because it anchors everything else. Because I try to explain how this multipolar world is being, let's say, organized, sketched, formed little by little. So this means those rules that we just talked a little while ago, rule of international law, primacy of the United Nations, respect to national sovereignty, no interventions a la shock and awe or responsibility to protect, be it Iraq style or Libya style, no proxy wars using terrorists, Syria style. You know, basically a concert of nations where we have some that's slightly more equal than others, but there's no hegemon controlling the whole system, which is what we had with Pax Americana for the past 70 years. So this I was, okay, the minimum, the minimalistic definition of multipolar world is different different nodes exercising power, but on an equality basis.
I guess the other interesting aspect of the book that sort of ties into this, I think, is you actually end up mentioning this philosopher, Deleuze, quite a few times throughout the book.
Oh, yeah. He's famous in American academia, but of course, very, very small circles in American academia. But unfortunately, in the U.S., he's not broadly known. He's very well known in France, very well known in Italy, for instance, translated in Spain, translated in Germany. Yeah. It's one of the most influential late 20th century philosophers.
I was mainly interested in why do you sort of use some of his ideas in the book, and maybe you could outline how you use his idea of the rhizome throughout some of the essays and chapters in the book.
Well, I was very much influenced by Deleuze. When even after I finished college, I read all his books in the original in France when they were coming out, in fact, when he was still alive. His most important book, Mille Plateaux, A Thousand Plateaus, which he wrote with Félix Guattari. It's an absolutely essential book to understand so many aspects of philosophy, psychoanalysis, and in fact, revolutionary struggle as well. I interviewed Guattari a long time ago. It was an amazing experience.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yes, I did. I interviewed Guattari in 1982. Long, 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 long time ago. And it was great because we talked a lot about Mille Plateaux and how they built the book. And he said, look, we built a series of fragments. The book is a series of fragments of intuitions that we have, but we had our broad idea behind it was a revolutionary struggle. What sort of mechanisms we can use to subvert this apparently monolithic order? Nah? And this is the concept of rhizome. Rhizome is like the best metaphor that I came up with is the Ho Chi Minh Trail during the Vietnam War. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was a rhizome, was an underground series of passages fighting against a bigger power up there. But meanwhile, you were underground and you were communicating. You were exchanging information, weapons, food, you name it, underground. So the big ominous power with all those bombs, they could not see what you were doing underground. So this is an image and a concept that we can use in terms of revolutionary struggle nowadays as well. That's why I thought it was so important, and especially to try to suggest this strategy for English people, English-speaking peoples, Anglo-American, unfortunately, because Deleuze, like I told you, he's not as well known in the US or in England as he is in continental Europe.
So the last two things I wanted to touch on. First, one of the aspects of the book that I think some people may find it controversial, you talk a lot about this rise of sort of biopolitics in the age of COVID. You mention Agamben, a great philosopher, who was very concerned about this when COVID first broke out. A lot of people attacked him and said, oh, you know, you're freaking out. We need to, you know, just deal with COVID now. But it does seem like we're moving towards this point of a really bad surveillance society that isn't going to be rolled back even when COVID subsides.
It's not gonna, you're right. It's not going to be rolled back. And that's why Agamben, you don't have to agree with everything that Agamben writes about politics, for instance. He's a philosopher. He's thinking the big picture. What does it mean, the fact that we have serial lockdowns everywhere and you have a sort of, let's put it this way, a medical dictatorship dictating our behavior, our future, how we deal with our kids, etc.? And he said, look, this is something that I have been writing about quite a while, which is the notion of a state of siege. And this was brilliant because basically, one of his first columns in 1 year ago was March 2020. He was saying, look, now we are leaving the state of siege live in front of us. They imposed a state of siege on us without consulting us as citizens, a top-down move, apparently provoked by a pandemic, but we don't know the real scientific extent of this pandemic. Is it as serious as they say it is? It's not the Black Plague, which remember that the death rate of the Black Plague was nearly 50% at the time. COVID, as we know, is 0.3%. You know, so obviously he got a lot of flack for that, but. In terms of analyzing the big picture, he was absolutely correct. It's what we're living now. And I reflect that in the title of the book, Techno-Feudalism, because big tech is on it, big pharma is on it, and it's a sort of a feudal system where you have this anointed or self-anointed tech specialists or specialists in nothing like Bill Gates, for instance, frauds, in fact, dictating to the whole world how we should behave, how we should raise our families, how we should protect our health. There's no wide debate about it anywhere. If you raise questions, you're immediately a conspiracy theorist, a denialist, or you know, or cancel culture goes after you. So what we would expect, that we would have a wide-ranging debate in the US, in the European Union, all over Asia, about all these policies that are very, very well coordinated in dealing with COVID-19. And what are we losing in terms of our personal freedoms? No, forget it.
And we even see this being applied in other areas, this sort of algorithmic control, you know, I'm noticing now that anyone who has a criticism of U.S. foreign policy is being called a Russian asset. The other thing that's starting now, I don't know if you've noticed this, but places like the Quincy Institute, which are very much anti-interventionist, they're being called Koch stooges, you know, Koch brothers stooges. You can't criticize any of this anymore. And the algorithms are blocking people out with even the most mild criticisms.
You're right. Absolutely right. So this all fits into the state of siege scenario described by Agamben a year ago, the techno-feudalist mentality, which was very well described by an economist from the Sorbonne. In fact, I took this concept from him. He is fully credited in the book because one of the columns in the book is a review, probably the first review in English, of his book, which was only published in France. And it's called Techno-Feudalism. And even in France, you know, the repercussion was because, you know, the mainstream media in France, they hate that kind of narrative, which deconstructs everything. So he was, you know, he only showed up in small independent websites. Nobody in big media was talking with him.
I guess what really surprises people, I think, too, is that we've had these rolling lockdowns in the West, but countries in the East, and I think it's not just China. I forget if you mentioned in the book, I think it was South Korea or...
South Korea was very effective.
Why was that? Why was there so much better handling of this in the East?
There's so many reasons. This is something that... will be enough to write a 500-page book only on the collective mentality across Asia in how to deal with something like that. And, okay, you respect the directives because you're thinking about the common good. So this is what happened in South Korea, in Japan, in Taiwan, here where I live, where we had a pretty, pretty hardcore lockdown, and they locked the country completely. If we leave Thailand to come back, it's very complicated. Even if we live here, so they knew that they had to be drastic. Thailand had 95 deaths total in COVID. compare this to the U.S., Spain, Italy, France, U.K., etc. It's a completely different mentality. Singapore, same thing. So you know they. Isolated the areas that they thought, oh, this is a cluster. They tested everybody. They experimented with, before the vaccines, they experimented with everything. So it works. And of course, it's an enormous difference of mentality. For instance, all across Asia, it's normal for people to wear masks. Before, it was against pollution. So nowadays, if you have to go out and walk in the street wearing a mask, it's normal here in Hong Kong, in China, in Singapore, in South Korea, in Japan. It's no big deal. It's normal. You're not going to have a revolution in the street because of that. Because you're thinking about the other. You know, it's a collective mindset.
There's a willingness to make sacrifices for the greater good.
And a willingness to make sacrifices because, you know, look, if I make a small sacrifice here, it's for the good of the community. It's for the good of the nation. So this changes everything. And then, of course, if you go back, you see that they are practicing basically what you study in Buddhism, what you study in Taoism, in terms of respecting authority, what they studied in Confucianism, and applying that to a very serious health problem. So no wonder if you compare the practical results, East and West, is absurd. You know? And there's nobody here complaining about techno-feudalism, for instance. In China, China is a very, very complex case. We would need hours to explain because it ties with the social credit system. The social credit system in China is not an Orwellian plot to control everybody. Essentially, is a way to regulate people's behavior in terms of how they are behaving to the benefit of the community. So this is the rationale behind it. You know, it works for Chinese society. It doesn't mean that you're going to apply an equivalent of the social credit system in the United States or in some European countries. It will never work. You would never, but it works for their society.
So I've kept you over the hour here, so I want to be letting you go, but I have to get one more thing in here, and it's just because I've always wondered about okay. it, and it's a curveball question, but I've All noticed right. in a lot of your writings that you reference David Lynch's Twin Peaks and the Black Lodge and all this imagery from the Twin Peaks mythos. I've always wondered, what is it about Twin Peaks that you find sort of useful in your writing and maybe the imagery you want to evoke in your writing?
Well, I grew up with American pop culture. In fact, my original cultures are classic European culture, literature, philosophy, etc., and American pop culture. I had a 3,000 vinyl record collection. And most are American bands. So, you know, for me, it's normal to deal with American pop culture. And to answer your question synthetically, it's that famous motto in Twin Peaks. The owls don't look what they seem. It's all there. It's all there. So you have to dig much deeper. You know, you have to go to the Black Lodge. You have to go behind the red curtains to try to find something that makes sense. And sometimes it doesn't as well. I think that that's the most brilliant concept in Twin Peaks, because it's shadow play all the time. It's mirrors intersecting all the time. And you see a particle of truth here. You see a reflection over there. And sometimes the reflection is truer than fiction. That's what makes it so... And reality many times is like that. And trying to identify what is real in this ballet in the middle of all these mirrors is very hard. But we have to try at least.
Well, I guess we'll be watching the owls. I hope you'll join us again at some point in the future on Parallax Views again. But for my listeners, how can they get a hold of the book? And thank you again, Pepe, for coming on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure. Well, it's on Amazon. You can buy it all formats, including Kindle, which is not expensive at all. So easy to find. And if you don't want to use Amazon, and I understand why many people don't, you just need to order from your favorite bookseller by the title. Very simple. And the publisher is Nimble Books. It's a small publisher in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Pepe Escobar. Check out his new book, The Raging Twenties: Great Power Politics Meets Techno-Feudalism. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Ryan, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.